ladies, gentlemen, students, faculty, staff, conference participants, and distinguished guests. On behalf of Dutchess Community College, I would like to welcome to you a very special luncheon today sponsored by the Student Association. Our guest is a gentleman whose quest for his roots has brought us to the saga of a black family. He was a self-taught writer whose career began when he was in the United States Coast Guard. After returning from the service, he continued his writing career only to be repeatedly rejected. Finally, down to his last 18 cents in his pockets and two cans of sardines, his luck changed. He began getting assignments from Reader's Digest and later from Playboy magazine. In 1965, his first book was published, which was titled The Autobiography of Malcolm X. During the same year, he began research that would then take him for the next 12 years of his life, where he discovered that he was part of the Madika tribe of Africa. He also discovered there a language, whereas Yaro is tree, Silo is the road, Tilo is the sun, Balungo is the river. But most of all, he discovered Kunta Kinte. Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to introduce to you Mr. Alex Taylor.
For this kind of a reception. I've been going about the country a good deal here in the last couple of weeks, and before that I was mostly in Los Angeles, and since the film came out about the book roots, there have been lots of people who have come up in different places and asked such things as what happened. Why did such a public response occur around the country? And I really can't answer that in the sense that it's asking more than anyone else can. I think that it's just being reasonably intelligent, though, to know that no one individual or no committee of people could really sit down and predictably prepare any book or any film which would have the kind of galvanic national spontaneous effect that Roots has had. And so it seems, again, only intelligence to me to feel that I have been, instead of the individual who did it, I have been a channel, a conduit through whom it has happened. And the best way I know to sort of a comment for myself on its seeming appropriate coming at this particular time in this particular place is a saying that my grandmother used to use a lot when I was growing up. She would say it around church, and she would say it occasionally to those of us in the family. And what she would say was, the Lord might not come when you expect him to, but he will always be on time. And I kind of think that about Roots. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that the best thing I might be able to do here this afternoon is try and share with you what essentially was how this book, and of course subsequently the film, actually came into being. It started back before I had the slightest idea about anything concerned with communications, other than just talking with somebody. It was really when I was a little boy, I lived in a little town of which very likely you never heard, called Henning, Tennessee. It's about 50 miles north of Memphis. I lived there with my parents in the home of my mother's mother. My grandmother and I were very close, and every summer that I can remember, my grandmother, who was a widow, would bring or would invite various women members of the family to come and spend some or all of the summer with her. They came from places which, in the context of a little boy growing up in Henning, Tennessee, sounded very glamorous, like St. Louis, Inkster, Michigan, Carbondale, Tennessee, Kansas City. They had names like Aunt Liz, Aunt Plus, Aunt Viney, Cousin Georgia, such as that. And I remember that from the time I was of earliest memory at all, they would come there, and each evening across those summers, after supper, as we call the evening meal, they would wash the dishes, and then they would kind of filter out onto the front porch. It would be, in time terms, about as dusk deepened into early night, lightning bugs flickering around over the honeysuckle vines just out beyond the porch. And they would each take seats in cane bottom rocking chairs, and they just kind of rock back and forth, like so many metronomes, as I recall them. And I would always be with them. No one ever said I should be, and no one ever said I shouldn't. I was just very, very close to my grandmother, and I would always kind of sit behind her chair as she would rock with them. And I remember that they would talk about people, they'd talk about places, about things. And as a little boy, I didn't understand most that they talked about, simply because, being so little, I just didn't have the orientation to understand. When, for instance, they would speak about people, and they would talk about an old massa, I didn't know what an old massa was. I didn't know what an old missus was. When they spoke of places and spoke of a plantation, I did not know what that was, although after a while I began to figure it must be something rather like a farm. And every now and then, I know that my first impressions that whatever they talked about was something which went a long way back would come when some of them would start talking about something which had occurred in their own girlhood. And now and then, one would turn around rather abruptly and sort of fling a hand down toward me behind my grandmother's chair and exclaim something such as, "I wasn't any bigger than this young one here." And the very idea that someone as old and gray and wrinkled as they had once been no older or bigger than I was just blew my mind. I just couldn't believe it. But it did make me know eventually that whatever they were talking about was something which obviously went a long way back. When they would speak of people, the furthest back person they would ever talk about was someone whom they called the African. And they would tell how this African was brought on a ship to this country, to a place which they pronounced as Naples. And they would tell how he was brought off that ship by a man whom they described as Massa John Waller, who had a plantation in Spotsylvania County, Virginia. And they told how this African desperately kept trying to escape. The first three times he escaped, he was caught, brought back, and each time given a worse beating than previously as his punishment. Then the fourth time he escaped, he had the misfortune to be caught this time by a professional slave catcher. A pair of them, I should say. I have since done some peripheral research on that profession, and I think that it is safe to say that there has never been a more bestial profession ever walked the face of this country. The story was that they cornered this African, and in his desperation, because he was such a repetitive escapee, he hurled a rock and hurt one of them rather badly in the head, but they still overcame him, and then they brought him back, and he was put before a group of other slaves who had escaped fewer times than he, and apparently one because he had wounded one of them, and two because he was such a repetitive escapee that he set up a bad example. They gave him the choice of punishments, either of castration or of having a foot cut off. And the story was, he chose the foot, and his foot was put on a stump, and with an axe was cut off across the arch. It was a very hideous act. As it was going to turn out, it was going to play a very major role in the keeping intact of the history of a black family down across literally generations. And that was for one major background reason that made it so very unusual. That was that slaves had almost no sense of that which we today know, value, and treasure as family continuity. The reason they didn't was because On the average, adult slaves, those of parent age, tended to be sold back or forth with enough frequency that their children, oftener than not, grew up knowing very little, if indeed anything, about who their parents were. And then when those children in turn had children, they knew yet less to pass on to theirs. And it so became that across a succession of generations, slaves as a body became characterized with very little knowledge of lineage, of family history. In this time, when this was the general case, this African, whose foot had been cut off, managed first to survive, then to convalesce, and he posed to his master an economic question. That was that he was crippled and he hobbled about, and so the master knew that he would not bring too much if he sold him on the regular auction market. And it was for that reason that the master apparently decided to keep this African on his plantation to do such limited work as he could. And that was how it happened, that in this time when slaves tended to be sold enough that their children knew little of them, this particular African, by his master's decision, was kept on one plantation for quite a long period of time. Limping, hobbling about, doing such work as he could in the vegetable garden where he was assigned, in time this African met and mated with another slave there on the plantation, and in the stories which my grandmother and great aunts and others told, she was described as Belle, the big house cook. And of this union was born a little girl, and she was given the name Kizzy. As the little girl Kizzy began to grow up, when she got to be old enough to begin to understand such things, it was now said that every time her African father got chance, he would take her by the hand, he would lead her about the plantation, he would point out to her various natural objects, a tree, a rock, the sky, a cow, a chicken, anything at all. And any object he would point out, he would always tell her the name for that thing. And this little girl, like any child today hearing an alien tongue spoken, learned in time these strange phonetic sounds. And she came to know that these sounds in time meant certain things to which her father would point when he made specific sounds. Among them, for instance, there was a stringed instrument that was rather popular in slave quarters at the time. And it was said that every time this African would point to one, he would say to his daughter, Ko, as if it were spelled K-O, a single syllable. And she came to know that to him, Ko meant that stringed instrument. There were numerous other sounds for other things. Perhaps the most involved thing was that there was running contiguous to this plantation in Spotsylvania County, Virginia, a river called the Matapamai River. And it was said that every time this African, with his daughter in tow, would point to that river, he would say to her, Kambi Bolongo. And she came to know that this odd sound, the Kambi Bolongo, meant river to her African father. There was about this African something which was characteristic of all those Africans in the ancestors of all we black people in this country. And that was that when they were bought off slave ships and taken to plantations, about the very first act was that they were given an anglicized name. And for all practical purposes, that was the first step in the psychic dehumanization of an individual or collectively of a people. The removal from that individual of the name with which went his or her subjective sense of self-identity, the same as it is with us today, whatever our names may happen to be. And it was said that this African was given by his master the name Toby, but that every time any of the other slaves on that plantation would address him as Toby, he strenuously would rebuff and reject it and tell them that his name was Kinte, a sharp, two-syllabic, angular sound, Kinte, that the little girl, Kizzy, came to know was, her father said, his real name. There was about this African yet another thing, again characteristic of all those Africans who are the ancestors of all we black people in this country or in this audience, and that was that every single one of them had been torn from some place where they had spoken whatever was their native tongue. And they had been brought to this place where it was a matter of necessity that they learned to speak as quickly as possible what was for them an alien new tongue, English. Gradually, haltingly, a word here, a phrase there, those Africans did learn to speak English in their own individualistic way that we now call idiom or dialect or such. And as this process began to happen with this particular African, He now, it was said, began to tell his daughter little anecdotes, vignettes about himself. It would appear, as a matter of fact, he had a passion about trying to communicate to her a sense of his past. Among the stories he told her was how he had been captured. He said that he had been not far away from his village, chopping wood to make a drum for himself when he had been surprised, set upon, overwhelmed, thus had been kidnapped into slavery. And the little girl Kizzy came to know the story, that he was chopping wood when he was set upon and kidnapped into slavery. To compress what would happen there, the girl Kizzy stayed on the plantation until she was 16 years of age, directly exposed to her father, his stories, his sounds, until she had a considerable repertoire of knowledge about him in her head from his own mouth. At the age of 16, Kizzy was sold away to a new master. His name was Tom Lee, L-E-A. He had a much smaller plantation in Caswell County, North Carolina. And it was on that plantation that within her first year there, Kizzy gave birth to a child, a boy who was given the name George. His father, or at least his sire, was the new master, Tom Lee, not at all an uncommon situation in the antebellum South. And as this little boy began to grow up, when he got to be 4 or 5 or so and could begin to understand such things, it was said that he began to query his mother about his father. Rather than tell him the truth that his master was the father, the mother began to tell him about her father. And so this little boy, George, grew up hearing a good deal about and becoming very proud of something kind of unusual for him, and that was his grandfather, this African, who said his name was Kente, who called the musical instrument Ko, who called a river Kambi Bolongo, who said that he had been chopping wood to make a drum when he'd been captured, and all the rest of the stories that came down from his mother Kizzy. In the pattern of slaving at the time, the boy George was apprenticed when he was about 12 to an old slave to learn a useful occupation. And in his case, the old slave was one named Uncle Mingo, who handled the master's fighting gamecocks. It was said that together with whatever Uncle Mingo could teach him, this boy seemed to have a kind of innate green thumb-like ability with his sport to the degree that by the time he was in his mid-teens, others had bestowed upon him the nickname that would prove indelible for the rest of his long life, and that was Chicken George. When Chicken George got to be about 19, he now met the slave woman whom he would marry. Her name was Matilda. And in time, Matilda would give birth to 8 children. Now it was Chicken George in the father role who set into motion what would later become a rigid family tradition, that every time a new infant was born, he would gather the family formally within the slave quarters or cabin. He would sit with the newest infant on his lap, and speaking ostensibly to the infant, but actually to the gathered audience, he would tell the story which had come down from his mother. And for that eventual 8 children of Chicken George and Matilda, it was something most unusual in the knowledge of slave children, and that was direct knowledge of an African great-grandfather, this same African who said that his name was Kente, who called the river Kambi Bolongo and other sounds for other things, and who said that he had been chopping wood when he was captured. As children will, those children grew up, took mates, and had children. The fourth of them, a boy who was named Tom, would become a slave blacksmith. And Tom grew on up, and in his latter teens was sold away to a man named Murray, who had a tobacco plantation in Alamance County, North Carolina. And it was on that plantation that Tom, the blacksmith, eventually met and mated with a slave woman whom he later would have children by. Her name was Irene. She was half black, half Cherokee Indian. She also would have eventually 8 children. And now, a generation later, it was Tom who would carry on the tradition begun by his father, that when a new baby was born, he would sit with the new baby on his lap and tell the assembled family the story which had come down. And for that second set of 8 children, of Tom and Irene, it was something all but unheard of in the knowledge of slave children, and that was direct knowledge of an African great-great-grandfather, the same one who said his name was Kente, who called a stringed instrument Ko, and a river Kambi Bolongo, who said that he had been chopping wood when he was captured. As fate would have it, of that second set of eight children hearing about this African great-great-grandfather, the youngest was a little girl whose name was Cynthia. And as fate was further to have it, Cynthia was to become my maternal grandmother. And I have told you at the outset how I grew up in my grandmother's home in Little Heaney, Tennessee, and she pumped that story into me as if it were plasma. It was by all odds the most precious thing in her life, the story of the family which had come down across the generations, much in the manner that I have described. I stayed around my grandma's until I was in my early teens, by which time I had two younger brothers, George and Julius. Our father, by this time, had gotten his master's degree at Cornell and had begun to teach at small black land-grant colleges about the South, and we were kind of faculty brats wherever he happened to be teaching. And then, as it would turn out, World War II came along, and I, the oldest of the three sons of us, was among the very many young men who thought that if I could hurry up and get into an organization of which I had recently heard called the U.S. Coast Guard, that maybe I could spend the war walking the coast some way or other. I did manage to get into it, and to my great shock, rather suddenly discovered myself on an ammunition ship in the Southwest Pacific. It was not at all what I'd had in mind. When I look back upon it now, however, it seems to be part of a series of meant-to-be events, which ultimately would lead into my writing a book called Roots. The first major thing was that I had grown up with my grandmother telling me that story and others, my great aunts, until it was indelibly in my head, much the same as the biblical parables I'd learned in Sunday school. And now the next thing, a major thing, was that if I was one day to write some book, obviously the first thing I was going to have to do was learn to become a writer, something I had never thought about, had never crossed my mind. And the way this happened, on the one hand accidentally and on the other hand meant to be, it seems now, was that I had been working on the ship until I got promoted to cook. And everybody on the ship, among the crew, our biggest problem was not the enemy. It was just sheer boredom. We would be at sea maybe 2 months at a time. Every night was the worst time. There was a running poker game. There was a running crap game. Different guys would do different things to just try to while away the tedium. And I got in the habit that every night after I'd finished cooking the evening meal and then washing the pots and pans, I would go down in the hold of the ship and take my precious possession, a portable typewriter, and I began to write letters to people, my ex-classmates, broadening it out to schoolmates at large, even teachers, anybody I would write letters to. Every now and then, ships would come out to where we were and bring mail from home and pick up our mail and take it ashore. Mail call, as this was termed, was a big event in our lives. And once I got things going pretty well, every mail call, I would get 30, 40 letters at a time. I swiftly thus got imaged on the ship as its most prolific correspondent. Now, concord with this, another thing was happening which was going to lead into my becoming a writer. Being at sea as long as we would be, a couple of months at a time, and being a bunch of fairly lusty young sailors that we were, and some pretty lusty older ones as well, I don't really have to tell you when we would get ashore what was our topmost priority. And we would go ashore and we'd do the best we could, and then we'd go back out to sea. And now there would be all these fellows on the ship smitten with some girl they'd left ashore. Girls have a way of getting all the more voluptuous in your mind the longer you stay at sea. And it began to be that a group of the fellows on the ship who, if I use present-day vernacular, might be phrased as the great rappers, the very vocal types, but they were not awfully hot on paper, began to come around and ask me if, since I wrote so many letters, that maybe I might help them write a letter to some girl or other. And I said, you know, okay, they're my buddies, and I want to be helpful if I could. And it rather swiftly got to a situation where every night, say around about 8 o'clock, I would sit in the mess deck at a mess table with a stack of 3x5 cards in front of me, and my clients would literally line up. And as they got to me, one after the other, I would interview them about the girl. I said, okay, now what's she look like? Hair, eyes, mouth, nose, whatnot. And what did you say to her? What do you want to say to her now? Anything special? And whatever he would tell me, I would kind of reduce to notes on an index card and put his name and her name on it. And then later, as I got chance, I would take each of these cards, and using that specific information about that specific young lady, I would try to tailor for him later to write in his own handwriting a kind of personalized love letter. And it would be something sort of like, say, well, almost all my clients were white. The great majority of the crew were white on this ship. So if a guy told me the girl's hair was blonde, as a number of them did, out in the middle of the ocean, I'd get into some fit of creativity and come up with something like, "Your hair is like the moonlight reflected on the rippling waves," or something like that, you know. Yeah. And these letters would go out, and I will never forget one day and night that were to prove most pivotal in my being a writer now. We had been at sea a little over 2 months, during which time three batches of mail had been taken off our ship ashore, so that each of my clients' girls had had these many letters. And then we got into Brisbane, Australia, after 2 months something at sea. Liberty was declared at 6 that afternoon, and everyone who had liberty just flew ashore. Around midnight, most of them had come wobbling and stumbling back to the ship, having accomplished the most they had been able so quickly, which was to get very drunk. But then it was almost as if a script had been written. Around 1 in the morning, my clients began to come back. Individually, each of them, before a steadily enlarging and increasingly awestruck crowd, were describing in the graphic ways that only young sailors can, how when he in person had gotten to that girl behind these letters I had written for him, that he just met astounding results, some practically on the spot, they testified. And I became heroic that night on that ship. And I can tell you the truth, that for the rest of World War II, I never fought a soul. All I did was write love letters. And it was not good. It got to be so, I didn't have to cook anymore. That's all I did was write the letters. And it was one night, I remember very, very specifically what happened one night that directly led me now to writing. I had been writing some letters, I'd kind of, you know, gotten tired of it, and I had a book of the sort that many of us may have, a kind that you like the book as a whole, and you tend to read it not in one sitting, but you read a little bit and put it down, read up some more later, something like that. And a thought just came in my head one night that I would type out, just sheerly copy, one chapter of this book. And thus intentioned, I propped the book up and began to type. I'm sure I hadn't gotten further than, say, about the third paragraph, when for the first time in my life I felt what good, disciplined, professional writing feels like, as opposed to informal letters or compositions or things like that that I had earlier written. And that was when I just got this odd compulsion to see if I could not originate on paper something which had the feel of that professional writing. And that was what really started me to writing. It was what would lead me into the next 8 years of trying to teach myself to write to the point that I could sell what I wrote. Nowadays, it always kind of bemuses me. Frequently, people will come up to me, as they do to other writers, whose stuff they have read, and they will exclaim something like, "Wow, what talent you must have." And I always feel it a mandate, particularly when I have the opportunity to speak to academic audiences, where there's a fairly high ratio of people who think about it that maybe they wouldn't like to be writers or like to be some other kind of creative artist. I always feel a mandate to tell the truth about that mythical thing people talk about called talent. It is not the number one requisite. It may not be the number two requisite. But if one aspires to, quote, make it, as the expression goes, in creative writing, and I suspect the same is true in any of the other creative fields, what one must have above everything else is a really extraordinary amount of self-discipline. That is the requisite. You have to be able to make yourself do more than any teacher, any parent, any other authority figure ever would think of asking you to do, simply because you personally are self-impelled to do that. I know that when I look back upon my own writing now, the most vivid thing I can remember about becoming a writer, self-taught, was that once I began that particular night, I wrote every single night, maybe 2 or 3 hours. I can't recall missing a single night, 7 nights a week for the next 8 years before I sold the first little article to
to a magazine, and in the process, of course, I had collected literally hundreds of rejection slips. I stayed on in the service, and I began to sell sporadically to men's adventure magazines here or there, and then one day there I was, 37 years of age. I had gone in the service when I was 17. You could retire at 20 years, and I did retire the following week. My determination to do so was that I wanted now to see if I could not make for myself a second career as a full-time freelance writer. I'd read, of course, a good deal about writers and stories about them and such. I retired in San Francisco. I flew straight to New York, went straight to Greenwich Village, and rented myself a basement room. I guess I thought osmosis was going to take it from there or something. But I went into a very rough time for about a year. I nearly starved for about a year. And then I began to get assignments, and eventually I began to work regularly for the Reader's Digest. I did the unforgettable character by an old sea dog cook who had been my boss. I did the drama in real life, and finally settled down to doing biographical articles. Then I went from Reader's Digest directly to Playboy, where by accident I happened to begin the feature called the Playboy Interviews. It seems somehow that most of the key things that have happened in my life happened seemingly by accident, on the one hand. And in the case of the Playboy Interview, it's kind of interesting to share with you how it happened to begin. They had given me an assignment to see if I could do an article about the great jazz trumpeter genius Miles Davis. I got after that story, and I soon discovered Miles did not like writers. He was difficult in general, and the whole thing of being around him and the people around him were just an adventure all of itself. And worse yet was whenever you did get to Miles, he just talked so very little, he was so monosyllabic, that it was almost impossible, I could see in conjecture, to get enough off him to really write an article about. To give you an idea of how loquacious Miles is, together with being a great trumpeter, a genius trumpeter, he is a most excellent cook. There were a little group of us around New York at the time, who guys who loved to cook, and we would sort of take turns or something. And in the case of Miles, if you were among his friends, you might be home, say, about 6:30 one afternoon, and your telephone would ring, and you would say hello, and a voice would come on and say, "Chili," and hang up. And the translation of that was that Miles had cooked chili and you should come over and have some that evening. And after I had spent some weeks trying to get enough out of him to write an article, and I knew I didn't have enough, really, of direct good quote stuff, and I knew you couldn't mess around with the editors at Playboy, sharp as tacks they are, and you couldn't do what we call in the writing business padding. And I was desperate to break into that magazine, and in my anxiety to do so, I came up with a gambling idea. I got to thinking that the whole adventure of having met Miles and moving around among him and his colorful friends had been as interesting as anything he had said. So I gambled on a form where I wrote a long expository intro telling about that aspect of Miles and his friends and his world and so forth, and then every syllable he had uttered, I put in direct Q&A following that. And the editors kind of liked it, and then when it was published, readers just were beautiful with the letters they wrote, and that was how that feature called the Playboy Interview got born. After that was done, I interviewed several people. Finally, Malcolm X was one of them. When that interview was published, among its readers was a book publisher, editor, Ken McCormick, who asked Malcolm if he would be willing to tell his life in book-length detail, and Malcolm demurred about it. He finally agreed that he would. And then Malcolm came and asked me if I would work with him on this book, his reason being that I was the black writer with whom he most associated articles in major magazines, and I was pleased, honored, flattered to do so. The physical logistics of that book was I worked 2 years with Malcolm X, the first year interviewing him, the second year taking all that interview material. I moved from New York City the second year up to Rome, New York, and I began to spread all that information out and to break it up into kind of chapter areas, or what seemed that they would work as chapter areas. And then I would take each chapter area and study the information intensively. And then I would sit down and start writing the first draft and so on, vicariously, first person, as if I were Malcolm. And finally, when the manuscript was finished, I went back down to New York City, worked with Malcolm 8 days in a hotel. He would take his red ballpoint pen, starting at page one. He ultimately went across the whole of the manuscript, making here or there a change or adding or something, or taking out something. And then at the bottom of each page, he would put his MX. And when that process was finished, Malcolm said to me, "Brother, I don't think I'm only going to live to read this in print. So I'd like to read it again." And he took that manuscript, the story of his life, and he went into the New York Hilton Hotel. I think it was room 521. And he stayed in there 3 days with that manuscript, and then he came out, and it was sent to the publisher. Malcolm proved to be very prophetic, because it was less than 2 weeks later he was shot to death in the Audubon Ballroom. It was just a galvanic trauma for me. I was upstate New York in Rome when it happened, and I got the call and stuff, and calls, and I just simply couldn't believe it. I had just talked with the man the previous day. Over that 2 years, obviously, biographer and subject, we had become and had a very warm interaction. And by the following morning, after a very rocky night, I sat down and began the writing of the only thing I have ever in my life written in quite that manner. Just dropping blank white sheets into that machine and drumming in bursts on that keyboard for some period of time, and then walking around hours sometimes, usually at night, come back to the typewriter some more, and eventually, it took me about a week to finish that part of the book which now appears at the end of the autobiography of Malcolm X called The Epilogue. It was just a tumbling from the memory of the recollections, the incidents, the insights, as best I could give them, which I had gained from this man. And then that was sent to the publisher. There was a saying in the writing business that writing a book is like having a baby, and I think it's not a bad analogy. Something that you have been very close to, which in fact you have internalized, and all of a sudden it's gone. You, the writer, don't quite know what to do with yourself. And it was in that situation for me now that I began to accept magazine assignments. And one of them took me down to Washington, D.C., where I had been interviewing someone on a Saturday morning, and it concluded at lunch. So I was sort of in a position that I just had to get on back to New York and write the piece. And that afternoon, just fiddling around, and I was down in that section of town, I came up and I found, looking up, I was at the National Archives. I had never been in that building. I knew it had to do with history. And something just, no big thing, just said, go in there. So I went on up the steep steps. I got into the lobby area, and I was wandering around looking at the various displays on the glass, historic documents of one or another type. And then I went on up into the service area, and a young man came up to me and said, could he be of help? And he kind of startled me because he walked up to me that quickly, and then it occurred to me I wasn't going to tell him the truth about what I really had been kind of kicking around my head for some time, and that was curiosity about some slave forebears that I had heard about from my grandmother in Alamance County, North Carolina. Her mother and father, Irene and Tom Murray and so forth, who she said had been slaves there where she had been born. So I said to him, I wonder if I might see the census records for Alamance County, North Carolina, 1870. Now the reason I asked for that particular census was because I knew it was the first one following the Civil War. Also, it was the first census in which black people had been listed by their names. And he said I could see them, so I went up in the microfilm room, and a machine was assigned to me, and pretty soon a fellow delivered the requested rolls of microfilm in those little cardboard boxes we know it comes in. And I sat there and I began threading a microfilm roll in the machine, turning the handle, looking down through the scope, and I realized I'm looking down pretty soon at this old-fashioned handwriting, where the S looked like S's, we've all seen it, of a census enumerator, 1870. As I turned the handle, each line, just names after names after names, each line, another name. And I turned the handle and it began to become almost mystic to me that each one of these lines, just some writing on a piece of paper, now on microfilm, was some human being who had lived and breathed, who had been born and had died a way back. And it was something just kind of grabbing about it. And I kept on turning, I suppose for the better part of an hour, and by that time, interesting as it was, it got monotonous, and I decided to leave, and it gives me to this day the quivers to reflect upon how easily, in fact, I might have walked on out of that archives and back out on the sidewalk, and if I had, I am certain I would never have given it a second thought. But what happened? On the way out, I walked through a room that's used for genealogical reading. And as I walked through there, my peripheral vision picked up something I had never seen before. And what it was I had been in libraries no end of times, as most of us have. And you know how when we are in libraries, ourselves and others, we tend to be trying to be as comfortable as possible, as casual as possible, and reading as easily as we can, whatever we have. But as I walked through here, I sort of noticed that everybody in there was bent raptly over the table, studying whatever they had. Some of the people even had magnifying glasses, their heads right down, poring over these things. I glanced a little bit more specifically, and the documents they had were old letters, scrolls, ledgers, so forth, maps. And a thought just sort of came into my head, rather as a bubble might go up within a glass of water of its own volition. And the thought was, these people are trying to find out who they are. And with that thought, I had nothing else to do. I turned and went right back up into the microfilm room. They had not removed my materials, so I threw the next roll in and kept turning. And I guess I was about three rolls further on when all of a sudden I found myself looking down upon Tom Murray. And then there was a column for color, B, standing for black. Occupation, blacksmith, and his age. Right beneath his name was his wife, Irene, and housewife, tending house, they phrased it, and M from Mulatto, and her age. Then right beneath them were their oldest children, their children at that time. And each of them were an age. And as I looked at these children in particular, the feeling began to grow in me sort of a mystery. I have heard this before. Somehow it didn't really crystallize for me until I got to the last one. There was Elizabeth, age 6. And that was what got me. I thought, for God's sakes, that's Aunt Liz. I used to sit on Grandma's front porch and play with her long gray hair. And it just grabbed me. It wasn't that I had not believed my grandmother, because you didn't not believe my grandma. But there was... It was that the words, that which always had been Grandma's words, that here it was in official United States records, on microfilm, in the National Archives, the same building which housed the original Bill of Rights, the original Constitution, for that matter. And it just absolutely grabbed me. A writer automatically, I took the notes, you know, what roll of film, where on the roll, so forth. And I got on out of there, turned in my stuff, and went back to New York, and the more I thought about that thing, the more my mind's eye went back to the source of all this, my little boyhood, sitting on Grandma's front porch of those summer evenings with all the old ladies there. And now as I thought of them, it occurred to me that with a single exception, all of them were dead. And that one, who was the one survivor, was the one we had always called Cousin Georgia. And I had this great urge to see Cousin Georgia. I remembered from my boyhood image that she just ran her mouth incredibly. But they would never, when they were she could talk all she wanted about other things, but they would never let her get loose about this thing about the family. So they would always tell her, now you be quiet, you don't know as well as we do, because you're too young, and she would just sputter with indignation. But they'd never let her get loose. And I remembered that, I would guess rather, that she was about 20-odd years my grandmother's junior. And I began to have this compulsion now, I had to see Cousin Georgia. I have in my family, as most of us have in our families, somebody who knows where every cousin is. And in my family is my immediate younger brother, George. And I called him up, and he said, yes, she's on Everett Avenue in Kansas City. I got on a plane, flew to Kansas City, and never will I forget that when I got there, after all those years, Cousin Georgia, the huggings, the kissings, the boy, you done grown up good, and all the kind of things you hear from the old people. But the minute I mentioned that story, Cousin George was off and running as if it had been the preceding afternoon. She said, "Yeah, boy, that African, he said his name was Kente. He called the river Candy Bolongo. He said he was chopping wood when they cotched him," and all the rest of it told in her colorful way.